This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, everybody, and happy Friday. Welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Well, I just got done watching the movie The Martian with Matt Damon. It's one of my favorite space movies. It's incredible. And I don't know how much of it is technologically possible, scientifically possible, or whatever, but it's a cool movie, and you know, most of it is spent by Matt Damon all by himself on Mars, trying to figure out how to survive until they can come get him. Anyway, I love space, anything related to space, and I don't know if you guys do or not, but we're going to go with a story from Science Focus Magazine, December 2025. Called Missing, the First Stars. They shaped the universe, yet the first stars ever born continued to evade the searches of astronomers like Dr. Emma Chapman. As an astronomer, I collect stars. There are several hundred billion of them in our galaxy, the Milky Way, so it's important to find a way to categorize them. While others might rank their stars by color or size, I prefer to order them chronologically. That way, we can simply look through them to read the history of the universe. There is, however, a glaring gap in my collection. The very first generation of stars are missing. And I'm not the only one to have encountered this problem. All the world's astronomers, despite the multitude of telescopes at our disposal and centuries of diligent observation, have failed to find a single one. If we're trying to read through the history of the universe, then our library is missing the first volume. And this is a problem. Stars are the way the universe grows and evolves. They're powered by fusion, where light elements, such as hydrogen, fuse together to form heavier elements. When they die, they explode in a supernova, flinging all the heavy elements they created inside their core into the surrounding neighborhood. This instantly enriches the pristine primordial gas with the heavy elements required for new stars, planets, and even life. You see, these first stars are different from all those that came after. Their novelty comes from their unique chemistry. Like all stars, they were born from clouds of gas that collapsed under their own gravity. As they were the first stars, they only contained the hydrogen, helium, and a sprinkling of lithium that was created in the Big Bang. This unique chemistry meant they had fewer ways to lose heat than younger stars do, and so the clouds stayed puffed up. This allowed the clouds to grow much larger before they collapsed, meaning those early stars could be several hundred times more massive than our sun. Now, on its own, the fact that they're massive isn't an overly astonishing detail. Many stars in the Milky Way are tens of times the sun's mass, with a few reaching around 90 times as massive. But these modern giants are vanishingly rare. Most stars that exist today are red dwarfs, smaller than our sun. If our understanding of how these stars grew is correct, then the first stars were a community of stellar behemoths. If such a star were in place of the sun, our sky would be dominated by a blazing blue-white giant with a surface temperature of tens of thousands of degrees Celsius. Its ultraviolet radiation would vaporize the oceans in an instant, and its visible starlight would be so bright that our atmosphere would bend it right around the planet, creating a perpetual daytime. This enormous size also explains why we struggle to find them today, as mass sets the speed of fusion in the star's core. The rule is counterintuitive but simple. The more massive a star, the shorter its lifespan. Stars are like cars. A hulking pickup truck has a big tank but guzzles its fuel. A small city car has a tiny tank but sips its contents and so can go much further. Similarly, modest-sized stars are frugal consumers of fuel, and so they linger. Meanwhile, gargantuan stars that are hundreds of times the mass of the sun blaze through theirs in a few million years before dying in a catastrophic supernova. If all of the first stars were such giants, then the reason we can't find them is because they all blinked out of existence over 13 billion years ago. The first stars were the ones to start it all, the pioneers that changed the universe from a dark, empty expanse to a bright, thriving ecosystem. But in doing so, they enriched that primordial gas with those first heavy elements, meaning pristine stars could no longer form. The first stars became irreproducible rare treasures. The first stars mark a pivotal change in the history of the universe. They're definitely worth searching for, and yet they remain elusive. Slimming down stars. The fact that we haven't seen these stars is a massive problem, literally, because while our theories and predictions suggest some of the early stars were stellar giants, we don't know if they all were. In fact, there's a growing number of advanced observations, experiments, and simulation that suggest the early universe was filled with a diverse set of celestial wonders, some of which might have been small enough to still be around today. Astronomy isn't generally an experimental science. We can't recreate a star or dissect one to understand its inner workings. Instead, we're restricted to observing what the universe has to show us. But earlier this year, researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Kernphysik in Heidelberg, Germany, conducted a rare piece of astronomical experimentation. Using a particle accelerator, they were able to create the conditions found in the center of a collapsing cloud of primordial gas. They looked at the first ever molecules created in the universe, a helium atom linked to a hydrogen nucleus, and discovered they were potentially far more important in early star formation than was previously thought. The presence of these molecules allowed the gas clouds to dissipate heat much faster, causing them to collapse sooner, possibly nudging the mass of the first stars down slightly. And remember, the less massive a star is, the longer it'll live. In simulations, too, the first stars have begun slimming down. For years, computing limits meant we could only model the very center of a collapsing gas cloud in detail, but struggled to simulate the surrounding disk of gas in detail. In the stars of today's universe, heavy elements help those disks cool and clump, fragmenting into clusters of smaller stars. As early stars only contained hydrogen and helium, we assume the disks of gas stayed smooth, feeding one enormous central star. Now astronomers have the computer power to simulate the full disk, and the results have been shocking. The gas wasn't calm at all. Turbulent motions, often supersonic, whipped through it, carving out pockets that could cool and collapse into much smaller stars. It seems at least some of the first stars were only a few times the mass of the sun. Stars that size live for billions of years, not millions, meaning there still could be some around today. Even black holes might have had a role in determining the masses of the first stars. Primordial black holes are theoretical entities that could have formed shortly after the Big Bang. They can be anywhere between the mass of an asteroid up to 100,000 times the mass of the sun, but even the tiniest of primordial black holes has enough gravitational heft to draw together gas and dark matter, accelerating the formation of the first stars. Meanwhile, the other end of the scale, massive black holes can actually disrupt fragmenting gas clouds, stopping them from collapsing and forming into stars. Since we've never seen a primordial black hole, it's difficult to pin down how much each of these mechanisms might have affected the formation of the first stars. But these simulations are important because they show just how much exotic physics goes into determining when and how those first stars form, and conversely, how much we can learn about physics when we finally do determine what the first stars look like. The key takeaway from these simulations is that there could have been a set of first stars that were much less massive than previously assumed, small enough to have survived until the present day. But finding them isn't easy. Hunting down the first stars. One of the main ways we identify certain types of stars is through spectroscopy. This method splits the light from a star into a rainbow or spectrum, revealing patterns that show the presence of certain chemicals. For example, if carbon is present, it'll cause very specific colors or wavelengths to be missing from that rainbow, creating a sort of barcode effect of dark lines. Each element has its own barcode or spectroscopic signature, allowing us to work out what lies within each of those points of light in the night sky. Thanks to its simple elemental structure, a first star's key signature is light that shows only signs of hydrogen and helium. Stellar archaeologists have come vanishingly close to finding one, identifying stars that have as few as five elements. This is still too many to be a true first star, but excitingly, these seem to be their direct descendants. From looking at the elements they contain, we can work out that these stars form from the detritus thrown out by the supernova of a single first star. We can even work out the mass of that star. At the moment, we have only a handful of these descendants, but we're beginning to build up an idea of what the ancestral first stars look like just from the heavy element inheritance embedded in their long-lived descendants. The difficulty with this kind of stellar archaeology is that a star that's been hanging around the cosmic neighborhood for over 13 billion years is going to have gathered some dirt on its surface, making it much harder for astronomers to spot. Stellar archaeologists have to look at each individual star and figuratively dust off the grime from what they think is the true light underneath. It's a slow, painstaking process, just like real archaeology. It could be that the first stars have been there all along, we just needed to blow the dust off them to reveal them. Resurrecting our stellar ancestors. The stellar archaeologists may be hard at work picking apart starlight to find potential low-mass first stars, but we shouldn't write off those high-mass ones just yet. Yes, they all died over 13 billion years ago, but astronomers aren't deterred by such matters. Not when we have telescopes, our very own time machines. Light takes time to travel, so the further we look, the further back in time we can see. To glimpse the first stars, we just need to catch light that's been on the road for over 13.5 billion years. But the farther the light has traveled, the fainter it'll be. The light from a star so far away that it's been traveling for 13.5 billion years would be 40,000 times fainter than the limit of the James Webb Space Telescope, that's JWST, the most powerful telescope astronomers currently have. But all is not lost. What JWST can see is galaxies from the era of the first stars. And now that we're looking at them, we found something astonishing. Although the JWST is looking at a time when the universe should have had very few stars at all, bizarrely, it's finding entire galaxies full of them much earlier than anyone thought possible. Even more perplexing is that many of these newborn galaxies already host supermassive black holes at their centers that are far too big for their age. They shouldn't have had time to grow to such an enormous size. What was going on in the early universe to kickstart these incredible growth spurts? Dark stars. One idea is that the giants of the first generation of stars were able to trigger something called direct collapse black holes. Massive stars emit a fierce amount of ultraviolet light, which would heat nearby gas clouds, allowing them to grow to thousands of times the mass of the sun. When gravity finally wins, not even the fusion that normally stops stars from completely collapsing can stop the fall. The entire cloud collapses directly into a black hole, potentially giving the overly large, supermassive black holes their early start. Another possibility looks to the unseen scaffolding of the cosmos, dark matter. This mysterious substance makes up most of the universe's mass, but we can't see it directly. We only know it's there from seeing how its mass pulls on galaxies. If whatever particles that make up dark matter can occasionally collide and annihilate, releasing energy, they might have powered an entirely different kind of object, a dark star. Instead of fusion at the core, dark stars are hypothetically powered by dark matter annihilation. Freed from a star's usual limits, dark stars could balloon to the size of Saturn's orbit while still shining brightly. When their dark matter fuel finally runs out, they too would collapse, forming black holes hundreds of thousands of times the mass of the sun. Whether these dark stars ever existed is still uncertain, but they might finally explain the oversized black holes that JWST keeps uncovering. Perhaps while we've been chasing the first stars, their spectacular afterlives have been staring at us all along. Even if the first stars are missing from my collection, perhaps the first black holes aren't. It's these kinds of objects that have made the long search for the first stars worth it. We should be careful not to ignore all the treasure we might have kicked out of the way in our rush to hunt them down. The fingerprints of the first stars are everywhere, in the chemistry of ancient stars, in the seeds of black holes, and in the strange new stellar categories they've forced us to invent. If this is the price of the search, then long may it continue. So as you can tell, Interstellar science has come a long way thanks to things like the James Webb Space Telescope, being able to see things that we've never been able to see before, and figuring out how to search for, theoretically, what were the first stars to exist in the universe. Pretty cool, I think. I mean, I don't understand all of it. Certainly, I don't understand all the science, but I'm amazed by what they're doing and what they're able to find out. And we'll just have to stick around long enough to find out more answers in the coming years. Next is a story from the same magazine, Science Focus, about social anxiety. I don't know about you, but I'm 66, so I was a kid 60 years ago, the word social anxiety I don't think even existed, but I definitely had it. And I don't know if you did or anybody you know did, but it was definitely a feeling that you were different from everybody else and you didn't know how to interact or socialize with other people. Especially as we got a little older, middle school, high school, for some of us, it was difficult, but you didn't go to psychologists or counselors 60 years ago. Most people didn't anyway. And I don't think the term social anxiety existed, but it certainly does now. So here's the story. All eyes on you. Social anxiety isn't only psychological. New research is revealing its biological roots and how to reset them. My first signs of social anxiety emerged when I was around 6 years old. I'd been invited at the last minute to the birthday party of a boy in my class. When I arrived, his older brother noticed that I was shaking. He asked if I was shy. "I'm just cold," I told him, even though it was the middle of spring. He looked doubtful as he took my arm and led me into their living room. My parents hoped that those fears would leave me as I grew up, but they continued well into adulthood. The shaking may have stopped, but my mouth would go dry and I'd blush heavily whenever I had to speak in a team meeting. Such experiences are surprisingly common. The UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence estimates that around 12% of people will experience social anxiety disorder at some point in their lives, making it the most prevalent form of anxiety. For a long time, it was seen as something purely in the mind, the anxiety being a reflection of personality rather than biology. But researchers are starting to see it differently. New studies suggest that the condition may be rooted in changes within the brain and even the gut, offering clues not just how social anxiety begins, but how it can be managed or reversed. Anatomy of anxiety. Before we begin exploring this new science, it's worth defining our terms. Almost everyone feels a little shy from time to time, but social anxiety disorder is an overwhelming fear of social situations, according to NICE guidelines. That's the acronym for this National Institute we talked about. People with social anxiety, these guidelines say, are afraid of doing or saying something that will result in embarrassment, humiliation, or rejection by others. They may worry about blushing, sweating, shaking, or appearing nervous, or fear seeming boring, foolish, or strange. Many also fret about talking too much or too little when anxious. It's different from introversion, a personality trait that describes some people's preference for spending time with themselves over large groups without worrying about how they perform in social situations. Introverts may find quiet solitude restorative and noisy gatherings draining, but they're quite happy meeting new people or presenting their work in front of others. It's perfectly possible to be both introverted and socially anxious, but the two don't automatically go together. I used to be very introverted as a kid, as an adult. I'm not so introverted anymore, but it's still there. And I can go into big gatherings. I can be around other people, even people I don't know. And I'm a little anxious about it, but I do okay. And I just need time to restore. Like it says, quiet solitude is restorative. Social anxiety, then, isn't about preferring solitude. It's about how the brain responds to perceived threat. And with advanced scanning techniques such as functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, scientists can now watch that response unfold in real time, revealing the three key brain networks that appear to malfunction in people with social anxiety. The first is the salience network, S-A-L-I-E-N-C-E, which includes the amygdala, an almond-shaped region deep in the brain that helps detect emotionally charged or threatening events. The second is the executive control network, involving regions such as the middle frontal gyrus, G-Y-R-U-S, a fold on the brain surface that supports focus, planning, and emotional regulation. Finally, there's the default mode network, including areas like the precuneus near the brain center, which becomes active when our minds wander or we reflect on ourselves. In a healthy brain, these networks constantly shift in and out of gear depending on what matters most in the moment. When you're reminiscing, for instance, the default mode networks takes the lead, helping you sift through memories and make sense of them. The salience network might then jolt into action if, say, you hear an unexpected loud noise, but most of the time it should hum along quietly in the background, not demanding your full attention. Holding a conversation, however, calls on the executive control network to keep your attention focused on the other person so you can listen, think, and reply appropriately. For people with social anxiety disorder, the brain may struggle to switch between the different networks at the appropriate moments. The amygdala in the salience network may become hyperactive so that you interpret the slightest change in facial expression as a sign of hostility, triggering those familiar feelings of panic. Or the default mode network may become overly active, fueling self-conscious thoughts and inner commentary. People with social anxiety are very tuned in to how they're feeling, such as the pounding of their heart, or they may be focused on how people are looking at them, says Dr. Franklin Schneier at Columbia University's Department of Psychiatry. In the end, it's the disrupted interplay between these networks that seem to shape how social anxiety takes hold in the brain. Yet that still leaves the deeper question, why do these systems falter for some people and not others? Gut feelings. For decades, psychology has explained social anxiety as something partly rooted in your upbringing. Several studies show that children raised on an emotional knife edge, given warmth one moment and coldness the next, are far more likely to grow into socially anxious adults. I think that might have been the case for my brother and I. But biology may also play a role. Twin studies offer one of the clearest clues of this. By comparing identical twins who share almost all their genes with fraternal twins who share only about half, researchers have found that social anxiety is partly genetic, with heredity accounting for around a third of the differences seen between adults. One of the other more surprising discoveries is that the roots of social anxiety may extend far beyond the brain to the trillions of microbes that live in the gut. The idea has precedent. Studies as far back as 2016 revealed distinct microbiome profiles in people with depression, suggesting that our mental health may be shaped in part by the organisms living inside us. To find out whether this would be true for social anxiety, Dr. Mary Butler at University College Cork in Ireland and colleagues analyzes the faces of 31 people with a disorder and 18 without. Sure enough, they found clear differences in the gut bacteria of the two groups, with higher levels of some species, they have names for them, but I can't possibly tell you what they are, and lower levels of others and those with social anxiety. To determine whether those differences could have a meaningful impact on people, the team transplanted some of the participants' faeces, and that's F-A-E-C-E-S, into the stomachs of laboratory mice before putting them through a series of behavioral tests. One test analyzing social fear conditioning proved especially revealing. Here, mice were given a small electric shock whenever they approached another mouse, causing them to learn that social contact led to pain. Butler and her colleagues found that the mice receiving their facial transplant from someone with social anxiety disorder were much more susceptible to this form of conditioning. They were also much slower to unlearn the association when the electric shock stopped. Crucially, the transplant didn't appear to alter behaviors unrelated to the disorder. The mice weren't, for example, more hesitant to explore an elevated maze, which would have indicated generalized anxiety. The striking part of our work was the specificity of the transferred phenotype, says Butler. The microbiota from donors with social anxiety disorder produced a social fear selective effect in otherwise behaviorally normal mice. In short, the microbes didn't simply heighten general worries, they seemed to transmit the hallmarks of social anxiety itself, making the condition, in a sense, contagious. Exactly why the differences in the microbiome might bring about these symptoms is unclear, though the team has some hypotheses. For example, there's some evidence that people with social anxiety disorder are more likely to convert the nutrient tryptophan, normally used to make brain chemicals into serotonin, into compounds such as quinurin and quinuric acid, which can disrupt how nerve cells talk to one another. The differences in the gut microbiota might be responsible for this, which could contribute to the altered connectivity in the brains of people with social anxiety. A better understanding of those pathways may ultimately lead to new treatment. Butler points to an observational study of student diets, which found that those eating fermented foods, which are known to be good for the microbiome, tended to show fewer signs of social anxiety. This doesn't prove causality, of course. For that, we would need a clinical trial that compares a random sample of people eating a new diet with a control group taking a placebo. But Butler believes there's certainly potential ahead. Interventions such as probiotics and targeted dietary change have already shown great promise in clinical trials for depression and generalized anxiety disorder, she says. Diets rich in fermented foods or specific probiotics might one day complement conventional treatment approaches. So even though a lot of us have heard that probiotics are unnecessary, this is kind of saying that there might be something to it, at least in regards to social anxiety disorder. Mind over chatter. Until dietary approaches are better understood, the standard treatment for social anxiety remains cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. In essence, it's a form of training for your mind. Over a series of sessions, a therapist helps you gradually face the situations that trigger anxiety while teaching you new ways to interpret your thoughts and reactions. The theory is straightforward, but putting it into practice can be far harder. The trick is to start with small challenges before building up to the things that really daunt you. You might begin by raising a point in a work meeting, for example, before giving a presentation to a few colleagues. All the while, you can identify the negative thought patterns, "I'm so awkward, I'm going to fail," that could be transformed into more positive chatter. I get that. We all get that, right? Where there's certain things that, certain areas of life that I just don't do as well as others, right? And when I have to do them, my gut reaction, no pun intended, is to feel like I can't do it, I'm going to fail, right? Until you do it, until you succeed. You can give your brain instructions at each stage, such as, "I can do it, even if it's unpleasant. I'm no different from others, and I've faced similar situations before," says Dr. Wasenlisso Panatti-Castro at the University of La Laguna in Tenerife. On a neuronal level, this approach helps to restore balance across the three core brain networks discussed earlier. It boosts activity in regions responsible for executive control while dampening the overactive responses of the salience network that instinctively flags threat. You begin a dialogue with the amygdala, Panatti-Castro says. With enough practice, he explains, these thinking strategies can bring about lasting changes in both the brain and behavior. Within a year, you might have someone giving a talk in public who was unable to do so. Cutting-edge research may help to accelerate that progress. One of the most intriguing is gaze-contingent music reward therapy, which aims to retrain the anxious brain's habit of scanning for threat. Developed by Professor Amit Lazaroff at Tel Aviv University, the technique combines eye tracking with your favorite music. It works like this. You're shown grids of faces, some neutral, some expressing disgust, while your gaze is monitored. The music continues to play only when you focus on the neutral faces, but cuts out if your attention lingers on the negative ones. In Lazaroff's studies, this approach has helped people gradually shift their instinctive bias away from threat and towards calm. After 8 12-minute sessions for 4 weeks, the participants showed a significant reduction in their symptoms of social anxiety, benefits that lasted for 3 months after the intervention had finished. Those in a control group who simply listened to their music during the session saw no improvement. Like standard CBT, gaze contingent music reward therapy seems to trigger measurable changes in brain activity. In one fMRI study of people undergoing the treatment, Schneier and his colleagues found that greater connectivity within the executive control network associated with focus and attention predicted better outcomes at the end of the intervention. Equally exciting are new strategies to manage the chatter in our heads using a process called self-distancing, pioneered by Professor Ethan Cross at the University of Michigan. At its simplest, this involves talking to ourselves in the second or third person, which normally would not be good, but in this case, it sounds like it is. Before work, for instance, I might say to myself, David feels nervous about his upcoming presentation, and go on to describe the things that I fear and how I might cope with them. It sounds childish, like you're channeling Elmo from Sesame Street, but Cross has shown that it can ease emotional regulation. As a result, self-distancing can soothe our stress in the face of many types of challenges, including difficult social situations. During one series of studies, Cross asked participants to practice self-distancing while they met new people or gave a talk in public. In both situations, the participants showed fewer nerves. They were more likely to make eye contact, for example, and to speak eloquently without too much hesitation, and less likely to fiddle with their hair or touch their face bashfully. Crucially, the effect of self-distancing seemed to remain at the highest levels of social anxiety, suggesting it could benefit anyone who feels trepidation at a forthcoming engagement, be that a simple trip to the shops or an upcoming TED Talk. I can vouch for its effectiveness. Since learning about Cross's research a few years ago, I've found my social anxiety dissipating. It's helped me to feel more confident at parties, in media interviews, and on the stage at literary festivals. As an adolescent, I had worried that my shyness would define my life, but as I enter my 40s, I know that it's no longer an essential part of my personality. Social anxiety, I've learned, is just a pattern of brain activity that can change. Well, that was interesting. Again, it's a little over my head in some places, but the idea is encouraging, you know, that there are practical ways, both through what you eat, what supplements you take, and what behaviors you can modify by just focusing on them. You know, I mean, it sounds pretty simple, and I know it's not, but I guess the point is that there is hope for those of us who have social anxiety. Our next stories are coming from Men's Fitness Magazine, February 2026. The 12 fitness upgrades these PTs didn't want you to know until now. PTs, I guess, are personal trainers. Train smarter, not harder. These smart tweaks will actually deliver actual results. You probably don't need to train harder in 2026 in a bid to get faster, fitter, or leaner. Busy schedules, life, admin, and long days in the office can make it impossible to squeeze in more training, no matter how motivated you are. And let's not forget your social media feed hijacking your focus and flooding your brain with fads, unrealistic workouts, and insane challenges. Instead, make 2026 the year you train smarter. We asked two PTs to share their many but mighty changes, which could have the biggest impact on your training regimen, from hitting the Pilates mat to actually making the most of your heart rate data. 1. Stop treating recovery as an afterthought. I tell clients to think of recovery as their hidden training block. It's when muscles adapt and your nervous system resets. Poor recovery equals limited growth, says Toby Spooner, PT and founder of fitness competition Metrics. Sleep, stress management, and good food are just as important as the work you put in the gym. That means taking rest days seriously, fueling yourself with whole foods, not just protein shakes, and giving your body time to repair before you hit it hard again. No pre-workout will ever beat 8 hours of good sleep, warns Spooner. Rest days don't have to mean sitting slumped on the sofa all day. Walk, swim, stretch, just don't burn yourself out. 2. Do workout-specific warm-ups. A couple of cat-cows and some floor reaches aren't going to cut it if you're hoping to hit a squat PB. Instead, Will Duro, PT and founder of training app 12 Reps, suggests moves that will actually prep your muscles for squats specifically. Think hip circles, leg swings, and body weight squats. These prepare your muscles for what's to come. Wake your glutes up, too, with glute bridges and banded squat walks. If you're kicking off with deadlifts, warm up your spine with cat-cows and some foam rolling across your back. For chest presses, try band pull-aparts, press-ups, and wall slides. The first 5 to 10 minutes set the tone for your workout, so use them wisely. 3. I never heard this one.
Strength first, cardio second. So you want to get strong and fit? The order of events matters. If you're mixing a weight session with a cardio workout, always hit the weights first. That's how you build lean muscle and make actual progress, says Duru. Hitting the treadmill before you go to the weight room fatigues your body and you'll likely just stall the strength gains you're after. A 12-week study in the Journal of Exercise Science and Fitness split 45 men into three groups. One did weights before cardio, another did cardio before weights, and the third did no exercise. The exercise groups trained three times a week for an hour. Although the group that kicked off with cardio did see some results, the group that did resistance training first lost more fat and boosted their muscular endurance and explosive strength. I don't know about you, but you know, I've been trying to lose weight for decades, and I do a lot of cardio. I've been doing more weight here in the last month or so in Florida, and you know, I haven't lost any weight yet. I do think I'm seeing some difference in terms of losing fat and muscular endurance, so it's helping. But do strength first, then cardio second. Four, train in different planes. Most people stick to forward and back or up and down movements in the gym. Think bicep curls, chin-ups, and lunges. These work in the sagittal plane, S-A-G-I-T-T-A-L. This plane divides the body into left and right for forward and backward moves. But your body was designed to move in multiple directions. To build real full body strength as well as better balance and coordination, you have to train in all three different planes of motion. Sagittal, frontal, and transverse. Frontal plane divides the body into front and back halves for side-to-side movements, such as side lunges and side raises, while the transverse plane cuts the body into top and bottom halves for rotational movements such as wood chops and Russian twists, says Duro. So this way you work your whole body in each direction. Five, ignore most people on social media. This is a tip that goes way beyond just fitness and training. This would be a good general tip for everybody. Ignore most people on social media. Social media is packed with fitness influencers claiming they found the exercise to transform your body. If you read any ridiculous claims that one move can do XXX, ignore it, warns Duru. Squats, deadlifts, presses, and rows have been around forever for a reason. Mastering compound movements with good form will build more muscle and strength than any trendy exercise. Unfollow anyone who makes dodgy claims and stick to your own trusted plan. 6. Stop falling for processed protein foods. If Joe Wick's recent protein bar campaign made you think twice about what's in your snacks, then you'll know about the potential dangers of overdoing the ultra-processed foods. Protein bars, powders, and other processed protein snacks might have their place, especially when you're short on time, but relying on them continually isn't the best for your health, warns Duru. Whole foods give you the fiber, vitamins, and slow-release energy that processed products simply can't match. The more ingredients you don't recognize on the label, the less likely your body is to know what to do with them, which might mean you feel sluggish or more prone to energy crashes, which isn't going to do your training any favors. Try swapping one processed snack a day for a real food option. Greek yogurt and berries, boiled eggs, or a handful of nuts work well and are quick to prepare ahead of time. I personally, and I'm not sure these are the best thing for me or not, but I do like trail mix that has a lot of nuts in it. I take those with me every time I exercise. 7. Don't be scared of periodization. Let's see what that means. Going through the motions every day with the same moves and the same intensity might fulfill your love of routine, but as Spooner says, nothing changes if nothing changes. It's also a phrase in AA and a lot of other places. Enter periodization. Periodization is a method of structuring your training into specific phases to maximize your progress and prevent plateaus, explains Spooner. Your body adapts to the stress you put it under, so mixing up your training intensity or volume over weeks or months means your muscles are continually challenged. Each phase of periodization focuses on a different goal, for example, building a base, increasing strength, improving power, or tapering for performance, adds Spooner. Personally, I use periodization depending on what I'm training for. Right now, I'm doing a 12-week training plan for metrics in February. I'm in the foundation building block phase. This block is 4 weeks long, and then I'll move into a 4-week block that's more focused on volume and intensity. 8, train for tension and time. Hitting a deadlift PB is great, but lifting heavy in every session might not always work in your favor. Instead, maximize gains by maximizing time under tension, TUT. Control the speed of each repetition, especially during the eccentric phase, which is the lowering or lengthening part of the movement, says Spooner. In a bench press, you might lower the bar slowly for 3 seconds and then push it back up quickly in 1 second. This would be a 3-to-1 tempo ratio. This slower eccentric phase increases the total time your muscles spend under load, helping to improve strength and muscle growth. The goal isn't just to move slowly, but to move with intention, maintaining tension throughout the full range of motion. So I do silver sneakers, classic training, which is a combination of cardio and weights. And something that our trainer has stressed over the last month or so is just this. It's go slow up, go slow down, and go with tension, like it says. So, you know, doing weightlifting or any other exercise fast isn't going to do you any favors. So if I'm doing bicep curls, I'm going up slowly and deliberately, and I'm coming down slowly and deliberately. That's what I've learned from the trainers, and that's what this is saying here. 9, utilize heart rate data. I definitely use this. I have a Fitbit, and I've always monitored my heart rate when I'm doing this. And always maxing out your heart rate when you're running or cycling, stop. Working flat out 5 times a week isn't smart, and it could hinder your progress. Focus on working in different zones in alignment with your goals. If you're marathon training, for example, steady state runs in zone 2 are far more effective than redlining every run in zone 5, says Spooner. Your max heart rate, 220 minus your age, is your starting point. Zone 5 is 90% to 100% of this heart rate. Zone 4 is 80 to 90%, and zone 2 is 70 to 80%. This is a conversational pace. You'll be breathing heavier, but you can still have a chat while you do it. So my max heart rate, mine, is 220 minus 66, which is 154, I think. Is that right? 40? Yeah, that's 154, which I do hit on a regular basis when I'm doing my exercises. FYI, your gender, fitness level, and genetics will impact your true max heart rate. Zone 2 training is particularly effective because it develops your aerobic base, your body's ability to use fat as fuel over long periods. These slower, steady runs improve endurance and overall cardiovascular efficiency, which is basically your engine, adds Spooner. Over time, you'll be able to train longer without getting tired as quickly. Zone 4 and 5 are anaerobic zones used for high-intensity efforts like intervals or sprints, adds Spooner. These are important to improve performance and speed, but they place more stress on the body. A well-balanced plan includes both. Long-distance runners benefit from spending more time in Zone 2 and less frequent sessions in Zone 4 and 5 to avoid burnout or overtraining. In short, going at it too hard, too often, just leads to pain and zero gain. Based on those numbers, I am way over, my heart rate's way too high when I exercise. If 154 is my max heart rate, then, you know, zone 5 would be 139, zone 4 would be 123, and zone 2 would be 108. And I'm always, you know, not when I'm walking. If I'm walking, I'm in the one, you know, I'm in zone 2 probably. But I go, when I'm playing pickleball or doing my silver sneakers exercising, I'm definitely in zone 4 at 123 and sometimes in zone 5 at 139. And with pickleball, I'm you know, between 139 and 154. So I don't know. That's definitely something for me to look at. Maybe it is for you too. Neat before cardio. If you drive to the gym to lift a few weights and do a 30-minute treadmill run before driving back home and spending the rest of the day on your butt, you're neat, NEAT. Non-exercise activity thermogenesis will be pretty poor. But Duro says that neat will burn more calories than any treadmill ever will. Unless you're running every day for long periods, you won't burn as many calories as you think. Non-exercise activities such as fidgeting, cleaning, walking, and even tapping your foot when you work will keep you burning calories all day. It's the real secret to fat loss. Plus, sitting for long periods can lead to pretty dire health consequences, increased risk of heart disease and diabetes, poor circulation, and serious back and neck pain. So that's interesting. Non-exercise activity thermogenesis. I know my wife will routinely get well more than 5,000 steps a day, maybe as many as 10, just by doing stuff around the house, you know, walking, cleaning, whatever, you know, moving around while she's talking on the phone, anything, you know, even tapping your foot when you work. That's incredible. So if you're, that's an easy way to, you know, burn some calories is just to keep moving, you know, somehow keep moving when whatever you're doing all day long. I go to give blood plasma, and one of the things that they recommend when you're given blood plasma is you move your legs back and forth, your feet back and forth. And I don't know, that supposedly that keeps the blood flowing faster. And if you think about it, if it makes the blood flow faster for given platelets, it probably flows faster for doing calories too. So keep moving. 11, ditch bro splits. Your body doesn't care what day it is, chest, arm, back, or legs. Instead of focusing on specific body parts, Spooner suggests training by movement patterns. Push, pull, hinge, squat, lunge, rotate, and carry improves performance and aesthetics at the same time and helps you move better in day-to-day life, not just at the gym. To grow a muscle, you need repetitive, consistent stimulus, just not one hit every 7 days. If you only train 4 times a week, you're better off doing 2 upper body sessions and 2 lower body sessions rather than 1 body part per week, adds Spooner. Focus on push, pull, and carry moves in your upper body workouts. Think bench press, dumbbell bell, rows, and farmer's carry, and squat, hinge, and rotate in your lower and core. Think goblet squats, walking lunges, and wood chops. And finally, number 12, Pilates is for men too. You won't find just ladies and Lycra at a Pilates class. More and more men are getting in on the action too. Pilates targets the muscles that tend to be neglected in typical strength training, such as your deep core muscles and the small stabilizers around your spine, hips, and shoulders, says Spooner. Training these muscles can help you gain more power and stability in major lifts such as deadlifts. Because it's low impact nature, it means you can stack sessions alongside strength training without burning out. So those are 12 really good tips on what to do. Just really small things that can help you become healthier and not waste your exercises by doing the wrong thing. So really good tips. Let me give you back those titles again. So stop treating recovery as an afterthought. Do workout specific warm-ups. Strength first, cardio second. Train in different planes. Ignore most people on social media. I'm off social media completely myself. I have been for months, and it's wonderful. 6, stop falling for processed protein foods. Don't be scared of periodization. Train for tension and time. Utilize heart rate data. Neat before cardio means fidget and move a lot. And ditch bro splits. And Pilates are for men too. Our next story is from the same magazine, Men's Fitness, February 2026, The Power of Sitting in a Circle, how Pasco Ashton and the Men's Circles Movement are helping men reconnect, rebuild, and talk honestly about mental health. When Pasco Ashton first sat down in a men's circle, he didn't know what to expect. What he found, though, was something quietly powerful, a space where men could talk honestly, listen deeply, and begin to understand themselves and each other in ways they rarely did elsewhere. It all started very organically, says Ashton, who founded Men's Circles in 2019. I've been on my own journey, doing retreats, looking inward, trying to make sense of who I was as a man. I realized I wasn't the only one asking those questions. That curiosity became a calling. What began as a handful of men meeting weekly online has grown into a nationwide network, from Cornwall to Scotland, where men gather to speak freely without judgment or expectation. The format is simple but structured. A check-in, a grounding exercise, a round of sharing, and clear agreements that create safety and trust. We start every session by reminding each other that all emotions are welcome, Ashton explains. It's about creating a space where men don't have to fix anything or pretend everything's fine. They just have to show up and be real. Breaking the stigma of man up. The idea might sound simple, but it pushes back against centuries of conditioning. From boyhood, many men are told that vulnerability equals weakness. Phrases like man up and boys don't cry teach men to suppress emotion, creating a culture where admitting struggle feels shameful. Research shows this stigma is one of the biggest barriers to men seeking help for mental health issues. Society has built this idea that being a man means being self-reliant and stoic, Ashton says. But that's not strength, that's isolation. And isolation is killing men. Indeed, men remain far less likely than women to seek support, even as they face higher rates of suicide and substance abuse. The issue isn't a lack of need, it's a lack of safe, relatable spaces. That's where the circles come in. It made me realize I wasn't alone. One man who's felt the impact firsthand is Peter Phillip, now a trained facilitator within the Men's Circle movement. His journey began at a radical honesty retreat, an intense weekend of truth-telling that left him questioning how disconnected many men, including himself, had become. There were about 20 of us, and it really struck me how many of the women there had bad experiences with men, he says. It made me think about what kind of man I wanted to be and the kind of relationships I wanted to have. I realized I'd spent years thinking I didn't need people when actually I was missing something huge. Back home, Philip typed Men's Circle into Google and joined a group. Within 6 months, he was facilitating his own. I wanted to help create spaces where men could do the kind of inner work that makes them better friends, partners, and fathers, he says. It's not therapy, it's connection. How the circle works. Each session begins with what facilitators call the agreements, a set of principles that establish trust, confidentiality, respect, and a reminder that all emotions are valid. Then comes a simple check-in where each man rates how he feels from 0 to 10 and adds 3 words to describe his state. It's a gentle way to start reflecting, says Philip. Just saying those words out loud can be a big step. A short grounding exercise follows, a moment to breathe, settle the nervous system, and shift from the rush of daily life. Then comes a warm-up question like, what's challenging you right now? Before one or two men take longer to speak more deeply while others listen. The structure gives permission for honesty, Phillips explains. You start with baby steps, and before long, you're sharing things you've never said out loud. Why traditional therapy doesn't always fit. While therapy remains vital, many men find traditional models hard to engage with. As studies show, conventional mental health services often rely heavily on verbal emotional expression, a format that doesn't always resonate with men shaped by cultural expectations of toughness or self-reliance. Some men just can't relate to sitting in a clinical room and talking about feelings, Ashton says, but give them a space where they can speak to other men with no agenda and no judgment, that's where they open up. Experts suggest therapy for men might benefit from being more action-oriented, incorporating problem-solving, goal-setting, or even physical activities such as outdoor workshops or team sports. We've had guys join our circles who've never gone near a therapist's office, says Philip. Now they're having open emotional conversations every week. That's huge. In many ways, men's circles are helping men rediscover something they've lost, community. We used to have more spaces like this, Philip reflects, in the pub, at work, in local clubs, places where men talked, shared, and looked out for each other. Modern life's fragmented that. The circles are about rebuilding those connections. That sense of belonging often translates into visible transformation. I've seen men arrive completely shut down, says Ashton. 6 months later, they're more confident, more present, more connected, not just to others, but to themselves. Changing the narrative. More and more facilitators are, like Peter Phillip, being trained to run local, in-person, and Zoom-based circles, bringing the model into communities across the UK. The goal is to make this as normal as going to the gym, says Ashton. You train your body, you train your mind. Why not your emotional awareness? For both Ashton and Phillip, the mission is simple. Change what it means to be a man. Men are often told that courage is about being hard, Ashton says. We're showing that real courage is being honest. Philip agrees. It's okay to talk about what's going on for you. In fact, it's vital. Once you realize you're not the only one, everything shifts. You stop pretending and you start living. Here's a short summary description of Men's Circles, a blueprint for better mental health. Start small. Check in with yourself daily. Ask, how am I really? Naming emotions builds awareness, the first step toward change. Not about you, but a lot of times my wife will ask me how I'm feeling. I'm not even sure. I don't know what emotions I'm feeling. Find your circle. Peer groups like Men's Circles or Andy's Man Club offer free, non-judgmental spaces to talk. Online or in person, they're a powerful bridge to support. Reframe strength. Opening up isn't weakness, it's maintenance. Just like exercise strengthens the body, honesty strengthens your mental resilience. Take action. If conversation feels hard, try something physical first. Walking, training, cycling with a mate. Movement can unlock talk. Lead by example. Share something real with a friend. Vulnerability is contagious, and you might give someone else permission to do the same. Now, I did a quick Google search of men's circles in the United States, and there's all kinds of websites with them. You can even ask AI on Google about it, but I mean, just Google men's circles and you'll find some probably in your area. I'm just looking here for Florida. Yeah, here's a place in Florida. There's Mankind Project Florida, Men's Circle in Fort Lauderdale, Men's Leadership and Growth Circle, a Facebook page for Men's Circle. Here's a place. They had a Men's Circle retreat in Miami back in October. So, I mean, Mankind Project, Meetup, Sweat Pals, Men's Giving Circle. There's all kinds of stuff. So just Google Men's Circles wherever you live, and I'm sure you'll be able to find something that you can give it, you know, just give it a try, right? I mean, it never hurts to try something new. And if it means, you know, making us better husbands or boyfriends or fathers or whatever, you know, it's worth the time and effort, right? Well, that's all the time we have for the Men's Hour. Hope you enjoyed it. Come on back next Friday when we bring it to you again. And please stick around and listen to all the great programming right here on Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Stay warm, everybody, and cross your fingers. It'll soon be above freezing again.